Welcome, everyone, to the Score Fantasy Football Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Boone, the lead fantasy analyst at the Score. Appreciate you hanging out with us today as we continue to get you ready for the draft. And this is when things really start to ramp up fantasy-wise. We get that like sprint for a week or two around free agency in March, then things quiet down. But then the draft comes around and it is one of the biggest sporting events on the calendar. And once we get those rookies onto these NFL rosters, we can really start to dial in on how things are going to look for the upcoming season. And we had Dane Brugler, The Athletic, on last week. We got some of Dane's skill position sleepers on that show. So make sure, go back, give that one a listen if you haven't already. And since we bring you nothing but the best here, we have another outstanding NFL analyst joining us today. It's Thor Nystrom of Fantasy Pros. You could find his top 500 rookie rankings over there, including comps for every player on the list. You can also find him on Twitter or X at Thorku. He is somebody who I play against in dynasty leagues, somebody who I have a ton of respect for his work and how he carries himself, both in the industry and as a fantasy manager. He is also somebody who I've wanted to have on the show for a while, and I'm glad we're able to kick off draft week with him here. So, Thor, welcome to the show, dude. You must be fired up about the draft finally getting going this week. I mean, after all the work that you put in, the prep is done. Now we get to see where the chips fall. How you doing, man?
My man, I'm doing awesome. Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here, and it's draft week, so it is so good to be here in draft week. It's a lot of work been done on all these different prospects, and all that's done, so I just get to talk about the guys, and that's so fun, and I'm excited to do that with you today.
All right, well, let's start with the fact that we're in sort of a strange time right now. It's kind of like the smokescreen season, right? The last week or two before the draft, nonstop rumors coming out, all these reports. Feels like most of it is probably a waste of time, but a few things that are being tossed out there, they're bound to be real. So have you heard any draft rumors that kind of have you intrigued, like something that makes you raise an eyebrow, kind of gets you excited at the possibility that could actually come true?
Well, I'm coming to you from Minneapolis, and ever since the day that Kirk Cousins, the ink dried on that contract with the Falcons, as you can imagine, the rumors have been hot and heavy here with the trade-up stuff. We hear it, all kinds of stuff, and I've been in, as I call it, conspiracy Thor mode, finding all sorts of different stuff. We all read the same sorts of stuff, that people put out, and then you hear stuff, both credible, and then you also get DMs from just random people. Hey, yep. I won't even get into that stuff. People claiming this and that. And then the more Charlie Day on the corkboard type stuff. and that's like earlier, January or February, the Patriots college scouting guy liked one singular tweet in the year of 2024. And that was a tweet that was speculating that the Vikings could give a Godfather offer to move up for either the number two or number three pick. That was a conspiracy Thor one. I thought that was raising antenna. Recently, there was a guy, Kevin O'Connell, was giving a speech in a church here locally. This was within the past week. And there was followed by a Q&A session. And some guy in town who used to be like a Division II quarterback and like sort of scouts quarterbacks on the side and puts his opinion out on the internet was in the congregation and gets up to the mic and asks a question about the evals of JJ against Drake May, which led to an interesting response by O'Connell, and then followed by an interesting back and forth about the trade-up possibility, and then very specifically, the possibility of a trade-up with the Patriots. Of course, Kevin O'Connell has a history with that organization coming out of San Diego State. It's where he began his career, and he still has a good relationship with Robert Kraft. Kevin O'Connell joked that he had sent a bouquet of flowers to Robert Kraft recently. So, yeah, I mean, like, you hear stuff like that. The quarterback one is where that is going to begin. The first set of fireworks we're going to get in the show is going to regard the quarterbacks on Thursday night. Would imagine you would have to think that the Vikings are going to lead that dance. Is it going to be with the Patriots? Is it going to be with the Cardinals? Is it going to be with the Chargers? Or there is the other one that is sort of the longer shot possibility is the what I call the calling the Giants bluff gambit, which is you put them to the, you don't trade with any of those teams we just discussed, put the Giants to the test on the clock, make them prove that they will take the QB4. That's the one where Kwesi would really be taking a chance. But if they did not, if they took the receiver, there's been some reliable reporting from plugged in guys in New York that they'll take a well, there've been quote unquote reliable reports on both sides of that. You know, people have been like, no, they will take the quarterback. And then other guys are like, no, they'll take the receiver, you know, and you know, however it goes. But if you felt confident in your read one way, you could try to call their bluff. And if they took the receiver, then that would mean the QB4 fell through the wickets. You wouldn't have to pay nearly as much in the trade. You'd also pay the quarterback for, you know, theoretically less in the slot. Of course, you'd still have to box out the Broncos behind you, but that's where the trades are going to start. And then I expect a lot of trade action even outside of that. Of course, that's what that first trade in the quarterback stuff, what we usually talk about, but I expect a lot of movement in that first round. The at the very top of the board, there's all those offensive studs. Of course, there's the four quarterbacks. There's the three receivers. Joe Alt leads what is a very, very good offensive tackle class. There's going to be a couple good of the stud offensive guys at the top. One or two of those guys are going to fall a little bit deeper than I think people think because of the numbers thing of this, which I think is also going to lead to trade ups, you know, as to stop the fall of guys like that. So I think we're going to see a lot of action on Thursday. I also think we're going to see a lot of action on early Friday because the receiver class is stacked into day two. So is the offensive tackle class at the top of day two. So there's some very, very interesting prospects up top there on Friday. So I do think we're going to see a lot of trades.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. And like you said, it's going to start with the quarterbacks. We know Caleb Williams, he is going to be the number one overall pick. There's still debate about who could go two. And then, like you said, what's going to happen at three, whether the Patriots are going to stick or not. And I know we've had people on talking about Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels and even Drake May. I haven't really heard anyone go to bat for J.J. McCarthy other than a handful of people online, including yourself, maybe leading the way. So why don't you lay out the case for why you've been singing his praises? Because, you know, I think a lot of box score scouts, maybe they didn't see the numbers from him in college, so they didn't really look at him the same way. But you and a few others have shown that the tape is good. And there are some underlying metrics that are pretty strong as well. So what are you seeing for McCarthy's potential here at the next level?
You brought in the right guy if you wanted the guy to go to bat for for JJ. First of all, was a stud recruit coming out of high school, has the pedigree with that, won two state titles in high school, which you could say is two state titles with one of them being a national title or however you want to say that in high school, because technically it's senior year with IMG. They were the considered the consensus number one team in the nation that season. Then when he went to Michigan, and people forget this with the, there's a lot of context that people do not bake in or don't know with JJ, which I think is how the narrative got inverted with him from the very beginning. They do the thing of like, oh, he was carried there by Michigan and you know, and different stuff like that. When he arrived at Michigan, it was on this rancid 2-4 team where the entire fan base wanted Jim Harbaugh fired. And J.J. McCarthy had committed to Michigan like a year or 2 years before that and refused to back off that commitment, even though everyone and their mother around the country wanted him. It was this chase of all the, you know, who's who of everybody to get J.J. McCarthy. And even though everyone wanted, you know, at this point, half of the Michigan fan base wanted Jim Harbaugh out, not only did McCarthy stay with the commitment, he was then helping Harbaugh to recruit, which is a part of the reason why Michigan got this insane recruiting class with him. And then they started to build a colossus. You know, once J.J. McCarthy got onto campus, they made three straight college football playoffs in his 3 years on campus. JJ got onto the field right away, didn't start that true freshman year, but played, I think, every single game. They used him that first year as like a change of pace guy for Cade McNamara. He was pretty clearly better than Cade McNamara when he would come onto the field. But they, you know, it was sort of like deference for the veteran. JJ quickly displaced him the second year as the sophomore. the rest of sort of history with that. The as a sophomore, there was some weeds in his game, and the, you know, some of the nitpicks that I hear about JJ were more apparent, the on-field stuff were more apparent as a sophomore, or were very real as a sophomore. Some of those things were addressed and are no longer issues, or were no longer issues the latter half of 2023, but people harp on them. I don't know, maybe they didn't see the end of the 2023 season. The 2023, particularly latter half of that, during the Murderers Row, that last half of that run towards the college football national title, when they're playing Penn State, Ohio State, Iowa, Alabama in the college football semifinal, then Washington, McCarthy was dang near perfect. He only threw one interception after the, I think it was the second game of the season. So the last 13 games of the 2023 season, only threw one interception. Some other just on-field stats. He was number five last season in on-target rate, in terms of the placement, with that stuff. He was also number five in the PFF stat wins above replacement, for the people that are like, oh, what was his value to the team and who carried who? There's this idea that, the Michigan offense, the Michigan team carried JJ. No. The Michigan offense needed JJ McCarthy way more than the other way around. They were in those third and long situations quite often by the numbers, which they did do the run thing, which hurt JJ's, on the early downs, which hurt JJ's counting stats. He got into those third and long situations quite a bit, which he was an absolute killer at, was by far the best in the class at that. People know that. I think that stat has been out there. That was why the offense was so friggin' efficient. You could not get them off the field, right? I mean, the clock would just keep running every time they got into the third and medium, third and long, first down. Defense knew it was coming. They still couldn't stop it. The accuracy there, the NFL concepts he is particularly good at. Number one among all the top quarterbacks in this class in completion percentage in the intermediate range over the middle. He was 85.6% adjusted completion percentage and a 91.2 passing grade on 97 such attempts. That latter number was number 17th most in the FBS last season. The going back to the counting stat thing, Bo Nix throws all the screen passes. JJ didn't have any of those. McCarthy threw less career screen passes than Bo Nix attempted in four of his five individual collegiate seasons. JJ McCarthy last year, because of the way that Michigan was blowing teams out, did not take one fourth quarter snap in seven of the 15 games that they played. So basically, two full games, or a little bit more than two full games, JJ McCarthy lost just because he hit the showers early, because they were slapping teams around. And of course, like, once it got that way, they were running the ball even more, earlier on in the second half. Yeah. So that was a part of the reason. Then the empty calorie stats of all those screen passes on first, they didn't do that. So we didn't get all the yak yardage from Troy Franklin breaking the tackles of the FCS opponent and the Colorado and the Stanford cornerbacks out there on the perimeter. But yeah, you have the accuracy with McCarthy. And then just speaking with the tools, and I talked about the recruiting pedigree, that talks to some of the tools that he has. As far as the athleticism, most unfortunately, we did not get to see him run the 40. I have a strong supposition, based on the reports that we have seen and based on his film, that he would have run in the high 4.4s had he run. What we did get to see was the three cone. He had the sixth fastest three cone at the NFL Combine, irregardless of position, despite weighing in at 17 pounds heavier than his Michigan bio, which also checked the box of any size concerns that anybody had about him. He very clearly has an incredibly strong arm, including while he is on the move. He proved the concept of that at the NFL Combine as well, as if he needed to, but he had a 61 mile per hour max velocity throw, which was 1 mile per hour beneath the record for that, which Joe Milton tied. Joe Milton, not the best quarterback prospect, but he does have an absolutely enormous arm. Joe Milton at 62 miles per hour matched Josh Allen's record for that max velocity throw. But again, JJ McCarthy was at 61 miles per hour. The thing that I like so much about JJ McCarthy's projection to the NFL, where I think it gets kind of scary, the thing he's special at is McCarthy is this fabulous athlete, you know, and he was an awesome hockey player in the past. He's done these different things. And he has the athleticism and he has the awesome arm. But some quarterback prospects, they are good athletes and they have good arms, but they absolutely do not work together with one another on the field. Joe Milton is an example of this. Jaden Daniels, arguably, as you know, he's a guy who has a lot of arm talent. He is a fabulous scrambler, but Jaden Daniels does not buy time with his legs and then, you know, throw on the run, for instance, right? It's like either I'm the thrower or when I tuck, now I am the scrambler. Now you have to worry about that. With McCarthy, those two things always work in conjunction. He takes his mechanics with him when he is buying time behind the line of scrimmage. He always keeps his eyes downfield. He keeps his upper body cocked to throw. He keeps the throwing platform under him and square. No matter how he is contorting around, maneuvering around, he is always keeping that thing square with the eyes downfield, ready to get the ball out immediately if he sees a look that he likes. This is why his accuracy is absolutely ludicrous on the move. Last year, he was 72% and change just in the aggregate completion percentage. That, keep in mind, contextually, was against by far the hardest strength of schedule of any of these top six quarterbacks. Michigan played the average 38th strength of defensive strength of schedule last year. For instance, Bo Nix played the 80th strength of schedule defensively last year, just to give you like some context, you know, as far as that goes. But J.J. McCarthy, so it was 72% and change in the aggregate completions, 71% and change on the move. So again, doesn't really lose anything whatsoever while he's moving and can throw frozen ropes to all three sectors of the field while he's on the move and sees the entire field as well. Very evasive back there. Very good under pressure as well. He's one of the few collegiate quarterbacks that you'll see this, a very rare trait where he does not fade away from pressure. You know, you never see that. Like a lot of these guys you see, like, They'll do the thing where they fade back from it, they brace from it when they get hit. Yep. They'll either fade back from it, or they'll put an arm up, or they'll contort in some way so the full impact of the hit, it mitigates it in some way. The problem with that is, like, you know, it's like, you know, you feel no big deal. Well, the problem with it is you don't get the full manifestation of your mechanics if you do that. And the problem with that is it has a deleterious effect on the accuracy of that ball. Does it mean that it will be an incompletion every time? No. But over the aggregate, over 1,000 throws, balls that would have been completed otherwise will turn into incompletions. J.J. McCarthy steps into the throw every single time. He does not fade away when he is looking down the gun barrel. He will take it on the chin every single time. It's a very rare trait. Even in the NFL, quarterbacks all the time, they're leaning back, but they're about to get smoked, different stuff like that. There are guys that do it, but again, it's very, very rare. He's one of those guys. J.J. McCarthy is very smart. Everyone around that's been around him raves about him. Obviously, his coach, who is a sitting NFL head coach right now, thinks he is the best player in the draft. That is the guy that J.J. McCarthy won a national title for last season as a 20-year-old true junior. And again, turned that program around when Jim Harbaugh, when J.J. McCarthy was getting on campus, really thought that he might get pushed out of what Jim Harbaugh previously said was his dream job, and instead, you know, saw this awesome 3-year run, and it went the way that it did, that ended in a national title. J.J. McCarthy, the whole narrative about him right from the start has been inverted the wrong way. But I think, you know, as the process has gone on, you've seen it correct. And a lot of that, I think, has come from the NFL, and you start to see that sort of filter through. So then he starts to get his just respect belatedly from the draft media. And it seems like as we're moving in on draft day, it's getting closer and closer to reality, where people maybe won't be quite as surprised with where he ultimately is selected when we get to Thursday night.
So incredibly, incredibly in-depth analysis. And that is the kind of analysis you're going to get if you're following Thor. I'm curious, though, after saying all of that, where would you like to see him land?
Well, coming to you live from Minneapolis, and as a lifelong Viking fan who has often wondered, will I die without the Vikings having won a Super Bowl? And J.J. McCarthy, one stat I didn't mention about him, 61-3, you know, going back to high school, I mentioned the titles. That guy's a winner. And I would really like my franchise to have a shot to go to the highest point. That would be ideal for me as a Viking fan. But I think that McCarthy, for me, I think he's the one where he could go. So first off, I think that he is, and I've made this argument going back to February. Outside of Caleb Williams, I think he is the best fit for Cliff Kingsbury's offense. Cliff Kingsbury, you look back to his history with quarterbacks going back to as an offensive coordinator at Houston, six of, and the, of course, as the head coach at Texas Tech and his time at the 1 year at Texas A&M or 2 years, however long that was, he's had nine quarterbacks as a starting quarterback. And last year, he elected to be the coach of Caleb Williams over bigger opportunities. He's had nine quarterbacks, six of them you could describe as creators, guys that extend plays, creators, buy time to extend plays to allow the receivers to flower their routes out. You know, like you think of like the air raid guy, I think a lot of people, casual fans, just think of like they're looking for a guy to sit in the pocket. That's not the guy that Cliff looks for. He looks for the creative guys that get outside the pocket, can create a little bit and then throw, you know, do the off script stuff and then off platform, different stuff like that. That's JJ McCarthy. The only three times out of those nine that Cliff had the true pocket passer guy in the pocket, he got stuck with it. The last 2 years at Texas Tech were two of those nine. And it was because he made a mistake with the creator guy that he ended up signing, and he got fired. Like Drake May, I don't know is a fit for like how I see Cliff, the decisions he's made with that. Now I know that it's not Cliff that's 1000% going to make that decision, but the guys that are the ones that hired Cliff to run their offense. So we'll see how that ends up going. But I also think that JJ is a very good fit for New England if they stick and pick there, because they need a whole lot of help, and they might need to have a quarterback that they needs to create a bit. And they also might be looking for a guy to play a little bit earlier on. That's my concern for Drake May, is that he gets tossed into a situation a little bit earlier because of the draft equity. That would be my concern with Drake May in New England. And for the reasons I stated before, I'm not sure that Drake May is quite as good of a fit for the Cliff Kingsbury system. I do think Drake May is a fabulous fit for the Vikings, and the ability to sit for a little bit and learn under KOC with a coach that coached Drake May in high school with Josh McCown. Of course, there's that connection and everything like that. I think the Vikings are the best fit for Drake May, but I personally, JJ McCarthy's a fabulous fit for KOC's offense as well. Those are the two best guys in this class at the heat ring intermediate throws. Beating the defense in terms of that is a central tenet of Kevin O'Connell's offense. The entire aerial philosophy is about forcing the defense to respect the balls that you pepper over the middle, the spacing you get elsewhere in the one-on-one shot, different stuff like that. It's because you force the defense to delineate resources to defending that area of the field. The JJ and May, they're the two guys that are the best at that. So, but I think for May, the Vikings are the best fit for that. But yeah, JJ would be my preference amongst those two.
And going back to the smokescreen season, I've seen reports, rumors, mock drafts that have had McCarthy, Daniels, and May going to basically all those teams near the top of the draft after Chicago, right? So we really don't have a great read on that one. What if we go to the rest of the possible round one QBs? There's been talk that Bo Nix or Michael Penix Jr., that one of those guys or maybe both of those guys could sneak into the first round. Is there a team or a landing spot that you think would be ideal for, you don't have to do them both, but for one of those guys, something we should be maybe rooting for on Thursday or even Friday if they end up falling to the second round?
I'll do Nix, and I will say Denver, although you cannot take Bo Nix in the first round. That's fireably egregious. I put out my 500 board with the 500 player comps on Fantasy Pros, and you know, I get questions about like, why do you hate Bo Nix? Because I rank him as QB7 and I have him as a mid to late third round prospect on my board. I don't hate Bo Nix. I think I'm the one that sees him realistically. I I watch him going all the way back to Auburn. I've seen Bo Nix more than anyone, but Bo Nix's family members at this point. I even went back last night. I watched even more and more and more, because it's like, I want to see something with that guy where, like, it, you don't want to be the guy out on the limb, because it's like, you know, like, it's not like, it's not, I'm not trying to root against people, and I'm not trying to be like hot take season. Like, it's just my takes. And so it's like, what am I missing with Bo Nix, right? Like, and this is from the start of the process when people were like, oh, he's a first round guy. I'm like, no, he's absolutely not. And I was fine putting that out, cause, you know, I'm pretty confident in that. But, like, you know, go back and watch his tape. So I went back through once again. I've done this several times with Nix, just trying to find something. It's the same thing every single time. So it appears as though, you know, we're now in draft week. I'm not going to get there with him. The thing with Bo Nix is that the Auburn tape, the things that he struggled with, having to sit back there in the pocket, go through the progressions, the throwing downfield thing, the getting smoked from behind by the pass rush when he had to do those different things. Going to Oregon, those things were not corrected. The offensive system inoculated him from them. And that offensive system then also very cleverly gave him all these freebie looks. There was such an enormous percentage of his passing output were these screen passes behind the line of scrimmage, which then he got a whole bunch of yak yardage. So that juiced up the accuracy. It also juiced up his yardage. And then the other stuff, you know, within the 0 to 10 was another enormous chunk of it. The stuff that was more downfield than that, it's all stuff where it was pre-delineated reads prior to the snap when he had advantageous one-on-one looks. He is like, he's like this pocket passer guy who all the stuff was pre-snap. The thing that you like is he's good at reading the defense prior to the snap. Like, there's several examples where, like, he denotes that the numbers on the one side, like, he'll change the entire plan of the offense because it's like, oh, no, that this defense, they made a mistake and we got to switch it. Like, there was this one play. I think they were, it was against Utah last season. If people have seen that one, and this Utah gets into this weird look, and they have a safety that for some reason comes down to the, this is pre-snap, he goes, they're in a single high, and he goes down to the right, and so they overload the right side, and it was very strange. There's a running back to the right of Nix, I think it was Bucky, and Nix, he immediately starts freaking out. He runs to the line and tells the line that he's switching the play. Like, he's having like this conniption fit. Then he tells Bucky, like, go to the left, go to the left. So he switches the whole play. And basically the thing he switched the play to was, Bucky, you're running down the field because they're in man coverage and they ain't got no one down the field who's going to cover you. All you're going to do is just run a straight line, and I'm just going to throw a lollipop to you. That's the stuff that he is good at. Right, like before the snap, he, you know, that sort of stuff. But the problem is he locks onto that guy every single time, right? Like, and with Oregon, when they were playing, you know, particularly, you know, again, Portland State and Stanford and Colorado, whatnot, they had all these advantageous looks, and he would pile up these ridiculous numbers, whatnot. And I saw over and over again on his film him missing wide open guys because he was locked on to the one dude. The other thing is this, the other thing I would just say of his career going back the entire 5 years, and the obvious manifestation of this is the screen pass thing itself, but it goes beyond that. There is a risk aversion in Bo Nix's game that is, I would argue, endemic. He does not attack the defense with his arm, I would suggest, because he don't got it there. He tries, even when he has some of these one-on-one looks downtown, instead of the thing of like leading the guy and try, you know, firing it down and using the howitzer because he doesn't have it, he'll lollipop the thing towards the pylon where he can guarantee in his mind in advance, oh, it won't be intercepted. There's no chance the guy will be able to make a play on the ball. But then he makes it way harder for the receiver. So I saw him turn for sure touchdowns into incompletions just because he wanted to mitigate the odds that maybe it would get intercepted. So I just saw different stuff like that. Him going to the NFL, could it be an efficient offense? I don't know about that because you're taking away an entire element of any explosivity. There's no way that Bo Nix is going to run an NFL offense that there will be an explosive element of at all. You can't do the gimmicky stuff that Oregon did. You're not going to get those advantageous one-on-one looks on, give it to him on a silver platter where he knows it pre-snap. It just doesn't work that way in the NFL. not available to him. So, like, you have to be able to beat people with your arm in the NFL. I've never seen Bo Nix do that over five collegiate seasons. You can't build a NFL offense around yak yardage on screens to the outside. Do I think someone's going to end up taking him in round two? Yes. I do think probably the best pairing would be with Sean Payton there, and at least he would get a shot to start early in his career. But yeah, I don't see Bo Nix being an above average starter in the NFL.
All right, let's move on to running backs. And people have been writing this class off a bit. I mean, in my experience, when the draft community or when the fantasy community just completely writes off a player or a group, they tend to go too far with it. And it rarely ends up being, you know, either as bad or as good as everybody assumes. But for this running back class, we're probably not going to see a running back go until maybe mid second round, because there really doesn't seem to be an obvious star. Do you think that that's going to make their values even more landing spot dependent here? Or is there somebody that stands out to you as a possible difference maker, kind of regardless of where he gets drafted?
Yeah, that's fair. I think that's where the mid second round is where you start thinking about running back. I think there's a shot that the first one is off the board late in the second round. There's also a shot that it's until the third, right? Like the last one where it was the latest, the running back win, I think it was the Bishop Sankey one. If you were setting that slot, it was in the 50s, 50 something. If you were setting that as the over under slot, I think I would go under, but it is in play. Like if you were to tell me right now that the first running back doesn't go off the board till the very early third round, I wouldn't be stunned. But I do think that we get a running back off the board in the second. But I don't believe that it will be before the midway point of the second round, you know, to the point that you just set up. I do think that it's a little undersold. I do like a couple of the guys. Like, it's just that we lack sort of the top tier, right? Like, we don't have that, you know, stud. We don't have the Bijan. We don't have the Saquon. We don't have the top tier. You could argue we don't have the second tier. But like after that, we do have some interesting guys. And then later on, I think we have, you know, in this era of football, we've moved to this committee mix and match thing. We have some interesting mix and match sleeper guys, depending on what your specific NFL franchise needs. There's some interesting flavors later on that might fit. But like, you know, for early on, I like Trey Benson. Trey Benson's been my RB1 with a bullet from the get. In 2022, he broke PFF record for forced missed tackle rate, became the first guy ever to have over 50% for that. He's also a freak athlete at shade over 6 foot, shade over 220 pounds, 97th percentile athlete, has the high 4.3 wheels as well. I like that ability to break the tackle to get to the second level, and then the jets he has. You saw the explosive element that he has. He also has the receiving utility. Norvell, going back to his Memphis days, you'll know this well, with those sort of multidimensional kind of guys, Gibson, Pollard, that he loves to do this where he will then motion them out into the slot or however he does it, and then do the screen stuff for them, get a couple of lead blockers in front of them. He did some of that stuff with Benson. I really like that. He also has concepts where with the play action game with them, where then the running back has to, you know, you do the play action, have to sell it, and then work through the traffic, the garbage in there, and then quickly make yourself available to the quarterback. Once you get through all that garbage and have sold it, Benson does that very well as well. And he has the receiving skill, and then you get that broken tackle utility with the athleticism as the runner once he has the ball in his hands. And he's a solid pass blocker as well, so you can keep him on the field. Last year, the constitution of the Florida State offense got a little wonky because their team got really good. But they Keon Coleman had come in. Of course, they had Johnny Wilson. They were throwing the ball a bit more. And Norvell's prerogative has always been to, right or wrong, has always been to platoon two running backs. Again, going back to the Memphis days. So the usage was, I would have loved for them to lean a little bit more into Benson. But that's why, you look at it statistically, was a slight regression from the year before, but I'm not as concerned about that. I'm a fan of Trey Benson. I comp him to DeMarco Murray, a little bit of a blast from the past. My number two guy in this class is Jalen Wright, a guy who does not have as much usage in college as Trey Benson, but he's got the tread on the tires. Or certainly the less medicals. Benson had a bad injury when he was at Oregon, and then transferred to Florida State and was healthy when he was at Florida State. But Jalen Wright was in a three-headed rotation when he was at Tennessee, and that's Josh Heupel's prerogative, is he loves to do these deeper running back rotations. Jalen Wright was at the bottom half of that earlier on in his career, but even then, everybody knew he was this ridiculous freak athlete. So much so, was so much of an open secret, Jalen Wright was on the Bruce Feldman freak list. Like, even when he was RB4, RB3 on the depth chart this past season, he did his sprint all the way to the top of that depth chart and had his big breakout. You see the explosive run utility with him. That's the coolest thing about hit aspect of his evaluation. Last year on one run had the highest top speed that was tracked on the GPS of any running back. I believe it was 22.2 miles per hour in the open field on one run. Had confirmed that with the high 4.3 speed in Indianapolis. 98th percentile at the RAS score down there. And then that was at 5'10 and a half, 210 pounds. As a runner, he's sort of like a more juiced up version of Tevin Coleman. It's the same kind of prerogative where he is looking for that straight ahead crease, and then he becomes the sprinter. You know, sort of the upright running, but just, I want to find that crease, and then we're sprinting. We're going to race angles one by one. But then he offers the receiving utility as well. So, a little bit different in terms of that, gives you that value on the other side of it. Showed that last year at Tennessee. And then one aspect of his game I think gets a little undersold is the pass blocking with Jalen Wright. So he's going to be able to stay on the field. He's not Alvin Kamara. I hate that comp on Jalen Wright. The guy that I comp him to that I think does a better job of hitting both the running and the passing game utility, and hitting the frame with the athleticism and the big play ability, the guy we just hit on, one of Norvell's old friends from Memphis, Tony Pollard.
Okay, so just like we did with quarterbacks, if we take the top running backs, so Benson, Wright, Jonathan Brooks, Marshawn Lloyd, Blake Corum, is there an ideal landing spot that you'd like to see for one of those guys, or is it just whoever ends up on the Cowboys?
Whoever ends up on the Cowboys.
There's a couple teams that we've talked about on the show before. There's a couple teams out there. I mean, even though the Chargers signed a couple guys, like, they could be a spot, and I know everybody points to Blake Corum potentially ending up there, especially if he falls to the third or fourth round. But yeah, that Cowboys spot is looking pretty juicy for whichever one of these rookie backs ends up there. All right, so we'll go to receivers next here, and we've talked a lot about the big three in past episodes. You know, they're in their own tier above the rest of the wideouts. Some people might even have tiers among those three, but if we dip a little deeper, if we go a little further in receiver, guys who might hear their names called in that first round, or at worst second round, let's say, guys like Ladd McConkey and Brian Thomas, Ricky Pearsall, Xavier Worthy, Troy Franklin. I know he's somebody that has been paired with the Bills a little bit by a few people. Let's put you to work again here. So is there a landing spot for one of those guys? You don't have to go through them all. For one of those guys who, you know, you would like to kind of manifest it by calling it out today, what's the right pairing of, you know, team and player from that group?
I would like, so one that I've been matching is, I would like, and this is sort of outside the box, I don't see this in a lot of mocks, but I like the idea of Ladd McConkey going to Detroit in the late first round. I think people don't see it as much because of they like to put the bigger receiver there. But Detroit has the clear need for the one starting receiver still. They have, of course, Amonra, and they have Jameson Williams. And I think people have made a mistake with Ladd McConkey and just being like, oh, he's just a slot. No, he's not. He played 80% of his snaps in college for a team that won two of three national titles and would have had a shot to potentially three-peat had they not lost. Very close decision to Alabama in the SEC title game this past December. He played 80% of his snaps on the boundary, did Ladd McConkey, for those teams at Georgia, and was extremely effective. Of course, Georgia played in a 12-personnel offense. Ladd McConkey could play in the slot, for sure. We saw him a little bit there when Georgia went into three wide receiver sets, which they did a little bit of. But he also can absolutely play on the boundary, and he can create separation wherever he is. And that's the best thing about Ladd McConkey. He creates separation as easily as you and I breathe air. He was destroying people down in Mobile in the one-on-ones. No one wanted any part of Ladd McConkey anymore in those one-on-ones. They started playing off the line on him. No one would challenge him. It's like, take the freebie reception and then I'll mime tackle you, because they didn't want to get embarrassed by him anymore. But no one in the SEC could cover him either. He's just so fluid. The understanding he has of routes for sure is high level. He gets in the head of his defenders, but the fluidity of his movement is what really stood out to me watching him in person down in Mobile. He just has a different style. Like I said, it's just really natural and fluid, beyond the sort of just acumen of the on field, the mechanics of it. And then he has the juice to get downtown. So you have to respect that. You know, you can't get up into his kitchen every single time. Like, you have to know that he can get downtown and make the play downfield as well. Has high 4.3 speed. So he can do a lot of different stuff. And Detroit, with their passing offense, not only do they, of course, every passing offense likes a guy that can get open and make plays all three sections of the field, but that they like to have the receivers with the versatility, move around, deploy from different spots, and can win from all those different spots in the alignment. Ladd McConkey could certainly do that. So that would be one as far as that goes. And then one other one, if Brian Thomas got down to the Chiefs in the first round, that would be one that I would like. The Chiefs, though, they might wait until the second round on their receiver. I do think the Chiefs take a receiver whether it's in the first round or the second round. The Chiefs might take the offensive lineman in the first round. There's the three-dimensional chess game there. I think the receiver position is a bit deeper, and you can get the guy who can step in and immediately start there in round two. And so it's interesting to think about who they would go out and get in the second round. One guy that I'm intrigued by that I think would be interesting there is Javon Baker. And it's interesting for me because I see a whole lot of a guy from the last class who I was banging the drum for the entire process, Rashee Rice, who ends up going in the second round. Obviously had the good rookie season, maybe not as good of an offseason, but Javon Baker is a guy that could end up sliding into the end of the second round. Has a lot of skills. I think was a little bit undersold, but he's been getting some helium as we move into the draft weekend. So he would be an interesting guy, I think, for the Chiefs as well there, if potentially the end of the second round.
All right, we'll get you out of here on this one. We got to give the tight end some love here. So who's your comp for Brock Bowers? And then again, where would you like to see him land?
Comp for Brock Bowers is George Kittle. The where I would like, so I'm on with the Jets at number 10. I do buy that only, but on the condition that the Jets do not have access to Rome Odunze. I've heard that if the Jets are in any way able to make a move for Rome Odunze, that they will do whatever is in their power to get Rome Odunze. If they're shut out on Rome Odunze, I do believe that they will pull the trigger on Brock Bowers. And I think that would be a great move. Brock Bowers, you can't think about him as the traditional tight end. He's just the ball mover guy. Like, think of him as Deebo Samuel, as the tight end. Like, you can hand him the ball, do stuff like that. You can deploy him from anywhere. Kirby Smart said if they had shifted him to running back over the past couple of years, he would have been the team's best running back. He averaged over 10 yards per carry in college on he only had like 15 touches there, but they did interesting things with him, gadget plays around the goal line. And then, again, you can line him up anywhere. You line him up in line if you want, but, in the slot, you can line him up on the boundary if you want, not put him in the backfield. If you want to confuse the defense a couple times a game, put him as a single back, do stuff like that. You can literally do anything. He is just the guy that you manufacture touches for to advance the ball forward. Do not think of him as a tight end. It is misleading to your own mind, the way that you think about that position. And the Jets looking for more weapons for Aaron Rodgers, I think that would be a really good fit.
All right. And that is all for today's show. So make sure you go check out all Thor's content over at Fantasy Pros, especially that top 500 list that we keep mentioning. Just a great resource there. I have a lot of friends over at Fantasy Pros. We talked before the show, Thor. I think D-Bro has the record for most appearances on this show, even though he seems to duck me every time I come on the Fantasy Pros podcast. But regardless, you guys got a great group over there. I got a ton of respect for your work. And maybe even more importantly, any time that you and I have had trade talks in our league, it's always a pleasure, man. It's really easy, quick responses. You're just so straightforward. It's a good back and forth, whether we make a deal or not. And we know we can't say that for everybody in our league. So thank you for everything you do, man. Keep up the awesome work. I mean, good luck with the draft this week. And I hope you'll jump back on with us again at some point.
It was so fun talking to you, man. And let's definitely do that. I have to get one closer to D-Bro in the standings.
Sounds good. As for me, I think I'm going to do one more episode on Wednesday, just a final roundup before the draft. Until then, though, big thanks again to Thor. Big thanks to everybody out there for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Said leave on time, my baby. Said leave on time. Leave on time with me tonight.